He might not. I'd like to talk to you, though. Right. We'll go straight to your office. Hardesty's gloved hand went to his chin and caressed it. I'd rather not talk about this in front of the other boys. Ricky sat with his hands on the wheel, his alert face turned to Hardesty, but his mind held only one thought.
It's starting. It's starting, and we don't even know what it is.
What do you suggest, Walt? Asked Sears. I suggest a sub rosa stop someplace where we can have a quiet talk. Do you know Humphrey's place, just inside the town limits on the 7 mile road?
I believe I've seen it.
I sort of use their back room as an office when I've got confidential business. What say we meet there?
If you insist, Sears said, not bothering to consult Ricky.
They followed Hardesty's car back to town, going a little faster than they had on the way out. The recognition between them, that each knew the frightening thing Elmer Scales had seen, made speech impossible. When Sears finally spoke, it was on an apparently neutral topic.
Hardesty's an incompetent fool. Confidential business. His only confidential business is with a bottle of Jim Beam.
Well, now we know what he does in the afternoons. Ricky turned off the highway onto the 7 mile road. The tavern, the only building in sight, was a gray collection of angles and points 200 yards down on the right.
Indeed, he blots up free liquor in Humphrey Stallage's back room. He'd be better off in a shoe factory in Endicott.
What do you think this conversation will be about?
We'll know all too soon. Here's our rendezvous.
Hardesty was already standing beside his car in the big, now nearly empty, parking lot. Humphrey's place, in fact, no more than an ordinary roadside tavern, had a long, peaked and gabled facade with two large black windows. In one of these, neon spelled out its name. In the other, Utica Club, flashed on and off. Ricky pulled in beside the sheriff's car, and the two lawyers got out into the cold wind.
"Just follow me,"
Hardesty said, on a rising curve of intonation, his voice inflated with false bonhomie. After looking at one another with shared discomfort, they went up the concrete steps after him. Ricky sneezed twice, hard, the moment he was inside the tavern. Omar Norris, one of the town's small population of full-time drinkers, was seated on a stool at the bar, looking at them in amazement. Plump Humphrey Stallage moved between the booths, dusting ashtrays.
"Walt!"
he called, and then nodded at Ricky and Sears. Hardesty's bearing had changed. Within the bar he was taller, more seigneurial, and his physical attitude to the two older men behind him somehow suggested that they had come to the place for his advice. Then Stallage glanced more closely at Ricky and said,
"Well,"
and Ricky knew that Stella had been in here at one time or another.
"Back room okay?" Hardesty asked.
"All his ears for you."
Stallage waved toward a door marked private, tucked in a corner beside the long bar, and watched the three men across the dusty floor. Omar Norris, still astonished, watched them. Hardesty, striding like a G-man, Ricky, conspicuous only in his sober neatness, Sears an imposing presence similar to, it only now came to Ricky, Orson Welles.
"You're in good company today, Walt,"
Stallage called behind their backs, and Sears made one of his disgusted noises deep in his throat. As much at that as at the negligent wave of his gloved hand with which Hardesty acknowledged the remark, Hardesty princely opened the door. But once inside, after indicating that they should go down the dim hallway to the dark room at its end, his shoulders slumped again. His face relaxed, and he said,
"Can I get you anything?"
Both men shook their heads.
I'm a little thirsty myself, Hardesty said, grimaced, and went back through the door. Wordlessly, the two lawyers went down the hall and into the dingy back room. A table, scarred by a thousand generations of cigarettes, stood in the center. Six camp chairs circled it. Ricky found the light switch and flicked it down. Between the unseen light bulbs and the table stood cases of beer, stacked nearly to the ceiling. The entire room smelled of smoke and stale beer. Even with the light on, the front portion of the room was nearly as dark as it had been before.
"What are we doing here?" Ricky asked.
Sears sat heavily in one of the camp chairs, sighed, removed his hat and put it carefully on the table.
"If you mean what will come of this fantastic excursion, nothing, Ricky, nothing."
"Sears," Ricky began, "I think we ought to talk about what Elmer saw out there."
"Not in front of Hardesty."
"I agree. Now."
"Not now, please."
"My feet are still cold," Ricky said, and Sears gave him a rare smile. They heard the door at the end of the hall sliding open.
Hardesty came in, a full glass of beer in one hand and a half-empty bottle of Labatt's and his Stetson in the other. His complexion had become slightly reddened, as if by a rough plains wind.
"Beer's the best thing for a dry throat," he said.
Beneath the camouflaging mist of beer, which floated out with his words, was the sharper, darker tang of sour mash whiskey.
"Really wets the pipes."
Ricky calculated that Hardesty had managed to swallow one shot of whiskey and half a bottle of beer in the few moments he had been in the bar.
"Have you two ever been here before?"
"No," Sears said.
"Well, this is a good place. It's real private. Humphrey, make sure you're not disturbed if you got something private you want to say. And it's kind of out of the way, so nobody's likely to see the sheriff and the two most distinguished lawyers in town sneaking into a tavern. Nobody except Omar Norris." "Right, and he's not likely to remember."
Hardesty swung a leg over a chair, as if it were a large dog he intended to ride, lowered himself into it, and simultaneously tossed his hat onto the table, where it bumped into Sears's. Then the Labatt's bottle went onto the table. Sears moved his own hat a few inches nearer his belly, as the sheriff took a long swallow from his glass.
"If I may repeat a question my partner just asked, what are we doing here?" "Mr. James, I want to tell you something." The gunfighter's eyes had a drunk's shining sincerity. "You'll understand why we had to get away from Elmer. We're never going to find who or what killed those sheep." He swallowed again, stifling a burp with the back of his hand.
"No." At least Hardesty's awful performance was taking Sears' mind off his own troubles. He was miming surprise and interest.
"No. No way, no how.
This ain't the first time something like this happened."
"It isn't," Ricky brought out. He too sat down, wondering how much livestock had been slaughtered around Milburn without his hearing of it.
"Not by a long shot. Not here, see, but in other parts of the country."
"Oh,"
Ricky leaned back against the rickety chair.
"You remember a few years back I went to a national police convention in Kansas City. Flew out, stayed there a week, real good trip."
Ricky could remember this, because after Hardesty's return, the sheriff had spoken to the Lions Club, the Kiwanis, the Rotary, the J.C.'s and the Elks, the National Rifle Association, the Masons and the John Birch Society, the VFW, and the Companions of the Forest of America, the organizations which had paid for his trip, and to a third of which Ricky by obligation belonged. His topic was the need for
a modern and fully equipped force for law and order in the small American community.
Well, Hardesty said, gripping the beer bottle in one hand like a hot dog, one night back at the motel, I got talking to a bunch of local sheriffs. These guys were from Kansas and Missouri and Minnesota. You know, they were talking about just this kind of setup. Funny kinds of unsolved crimes. Now, my point is this. At least two or three of these guys ran into exactly the same thing we saw today. Bunch of animals lying dead in a field. Wham, bam, dead overnight. No cause until you look at them and find, you know, real neat wounds like a surgeon would do. And no blood. Exsanguinated, they call that. One of these guys said there was a whole wave of this in the Ohio River Valley in the late 60s. Horses, dogs, cows. We probably got the first sheep. But, Mr. Hawthorne, you brought it all back to me when you said that about the no blood. That's right, that reminded me. You'd figure those sheep would bleed like crazy. And in Kansas City, the same thing happened just a year back before the conference, around Christmas. Nonsense, said Sears. I'm not going to listen to any more of this rubbish. Excuse me, Mr. James, it's not nonsense. It all happened. You could look it up in the Kansas City Times. December 1973. Bunch of dead cattle, no footprints, no blood. And that was on fresh snow, too, just like today. He looked across at Ricky, winked, drained his beer.
Nobody was ever arrested? Ricky asked.
Never. In all of those places, they never found anybody. Just like something bad came to town, put on its show, and took off again. My idea is that things like this are something's idea of a joke.
What? Sears said explosively. Vampires? Demons? Crazy.
No, I'm not saying that. Hell, I know there's no vampires, just like I know that damned monster in that lake in Scotland isn't there.
Hardesty tipped back in his chair and locked his hands behind his head.
But nobody ever found anything, and we ain't gonna either. There isn't even any sense in looking. I figure just to keep Elmer happy by telling him how I'm working on it.
Is that really all you intend to do? Asked incredulous Ricky Hawthorne.
Oh, I might have a man walk around some of the local farms, ask if they saw anything funny last night, but that's about all.
And you actually brought us here to tell us that? Sears asked.
I actually did.
Let's go, Ricky.
Sears pushed his chair back and reached for his hat.
And actually, I thought the two most distinguished lawyers in town might be able to tell me something.
I could, but I doubt that you'd listen.
A little less high and mighty, Mr. James. We're both on the same side, aren't we?
Ricky said, over the inevitable pfft of expelled air from Sears.
What did you think we could tell you?
Why, you think you know something about what Elmer saw last night?
He fingered a groove in his forehead, smiling.
You two old boys went into deep freeze when Elmer was talking about that. So you know something, or heard something, or saw something you didn't want to tell Elmer Scales. Well, suppose you support your local sheriff and speak up.
Sears pushed himself up from the chair.
I saw four dead sheep. I know nothing. And that, Walter, is that.
He snatched his hat from the table.
Ricky, let's go do something useful.
He's right, isn't he?
They were turning the corner at Wheat Row. The vast gray body of St. Michael's Cathedral hung in the air to their right. The grotesque and saintly figures above the door and beside the windows wore caps and shirts of fresh snow, as if they had been frozen in place.
About? Sears waved toward their office building. Miracles of miracles, a parking space right in front of the door.
About what Elmer saw.
If it is obvious to Walt Hardesty, then it is obvious indeed. Yes.
Did you actually see anything?
I saw something not there. I hallucinated. I can only assume that I was overtired and somehow emotionally affected by the story I told.
Ricky carefully backed the car into the space before the tall wooden facade of the office building. Sears coughed, placed his hands on the door latch, did not move. To Ricky, he looked as though he already regretted what he was going to say.
I take it you saw more or less the same thing that our Virgil did.
Yes, I did. He paused. No, I felt it, but I knew what it was.
Well, he coughed again, and Ricky grew tense with waiting. What I saw was Fenny Bate.
The boy in your story?
Ricky was astonished.
The boy I tried to teach. The boy I suppose I killed. Helped to kill.
Sears took his hand from the door and let his weight fall back on the car seat. Now, at last, he wanted to talk. Ricky tried to take it in.
I wasn't sure that...
He stopped in mid-sentence, aware that he was breaking one of the Chowder Society's rules.
That it was a true story. It was true enough, Ricky. True enough. There was a real Fenny Bate, and he died.
Ricky remembered the sight of Sears's lighted window.
Were you looking out the library windows when you saw him?
Sears shook his head.
I was going upstairs. It was very late, probably about 2 o'clock. I had fallen asleep in a chair after doing the dishes. I didn't feel very good, I'm afraid. I would have felt worse if I'd known that Elmer Scales was going to wake me up at 7 o'clock this morning. Well, I turned off the lights in the library, closed the door, began to go up the stairs. And then I saw him sitting there, sitting on the stairs. He appeared to be asleep. He was dressed in the rags I remembered him wearing, and his feet were bare.
What did you do?
I was too frightened to do anything at all. I am no longer a strong young man of 20. Ricky, I just stood there for I don't know how long. I thought I might collapse. I steadied myself by putting my hand on the banister, and then he woke up.
Sears was clasping his hands together before him, and Ricky could tell that he was gripping hard.
He didn't have eyes. He just had holes. The rest of his face was smiling.
Sears's hands went to his face and folded in beneath the wide hat brim.
Christ, Ricky. He wanted to play.
He wanted to play?
That's what went through my mind. I was in such shock I couldn't think straight. When the hallucination stood up, I ran back down the stairs and locked myself in the library. I went to bed on the couch. I had the feeling that it was gone, but I couldn't make myself go back out on the staircase. Eventually, I fell asleep and had the dream we were discussing. In the morning, of course, I recognized what had happened. I was seeing things in the vulgar parlance. And I did not think, nor do I think now, that such things are exactly in the province of Walt Hardesty, or our Virgil, for that matter.
My God, Sears, Ricky said.
Forget about it, Ricky. Just forget I ever told you. At least until this young Wanderley arrives.
Jesus, she moves. She can't. She's dead.
Spoke in his mind again. And he turned his eyes from the dashboard where they had been resting while Sears told him to do the impossible
and looked straight into the pale face of his law partner.
"No more," Sears said. "Whatever it is, no more. I've had enough."
"No, put her feet in first."
"Sears."
"I can't, Ricky," Sears said, and levered himself out of the car.
Hawthorne got out on his side and looked across the top of the car at Sears, an imposing man dressed in black, and for a moment he saw on the face of his old friend the waxy features his dream had given him. Behind him, around him, all of the town floated in wintry air, as if it, too, had secretly died.
"But I'll tell you one thing," Sears said. "I wish Edward were still alive. I often wish that."
"So do I,"
Ricky whispered. But Sears had already turned from him and was beginning to go up the steps to the front door. A rising wind bit at Ricky's face and hands, and he quickly followed, sneezing again. John Jaffrey. 1. The doctor, whose party it had been, woke out of a troubled sleep just at the time when Ricky Hawthorne and Sears James were beginning their walk across a field in the direction of what appeared to be several piles of dirty laundry. Moaning, Jaffrey looked around the bedroom. Everything appeared to be subtly altered, subtly wrong. Even the bare shoulder of Millie Sheehan, who slept on beside him, was somehow wrong. Millie's round shoulder looked insubstantial, like pink smoke floating in the air. This was true of the bedroom as a whole. The fading wallpaper, blue stripes and bluer roses, the table bearing neat piles of coins, a library book, the making of a surgeon, and a lamp, the doors and handles of the tall white cupboard opposite, his yesterday's gray-striped suit and last evening's dinner jacket draped carelessly over a chair. It all seemed drained of several shades of color, wispy as the interior of a cloud. In this room, at once familiar and unreal, he could not stay.
"Jesus, she moved,"
his own words coiled and died in the washed-out air, as if he had just spoken them. Pursued by them, he quickly got out of bed.
"Jesus, she moved."
And this time he heard it spoken. The voice was level, without shading or vibrato, not his own. He had to get out of the house. Of his dreams, he could remember only the last startling image. Before that, there had been the usual busyness of lying paralyzed in a bare bedroom, no bedroom he'd ever seen in his life, and the coming of a threatening beast which resolved into dead Sears and dead Lewis. He had assumed they'd all been having this dream, but the image which propelled him across the room was this. The face, streaked with blood and distorted with bruises, of a young woman. A woman as dead as Sears and Lewis in the familiar dream, staring at him with glowing eyes and grinning mouth. It was more real than anything about him, more real than himself.
"Jesus, she moved. She can't. She's dead."
But she moved all right. She sat up and grinned. It was coming to an end for him at last, as it had for Edward. And with part of his mind, he knew it. And was grateful. A little surprised that his hands did not melt through the brass handles of the dresser drawer, Jaffrey pulled out socks and underwear. Unearthly rose light pervaded the bedroom. He quickly dressed in random articles of clothing, selecting them blindly, and left the bedroom to go down the stairs to the ground floor. There, obeying an impulse stamped into him by 10 years' habit, he let himself into a small rear office, opened a cabinet, and took out 2 vials and 2 disposable hypodermics. He sat on a revolving typing chair, rolled up his left sleeve, took the syringes from their wrappers, and put 1 on the metal-topped table beside him.
The girl sat up on the blood-smeared car seat and grinned at him through the window. She said,
"Hurry up, John."
He pushed the first needle through the rubber cap over the insulin compound, pulled back the barrel, and socked the needle into his arm. When the hypodermic was empty, he retracted it and tossed it into the wastebasket beneath the table. Then he put the other syringe into the second vial, which contained a compound of morphine. This went into the same arm.
"Hurry up, John."
None of his friends knew he was diabetic, and had been since his early 60s. Neither did they know of the morphine addiction, which had gained on him since the same period, when he had begun administering the drug to himself. They had only seen the effects of the doctor's morning ritual gradually eating into him. With both syringes at the bottom of the wastebasket, Dr. Jaffrey came out into his entrance hall and waiting room. Empty chairs stood in rows against the walls. On one of these appeared a girl in torn clothing, red smears across her face, redness leaking from her mouth when she said,
"Hurry up, John."
He reached into a closet for his overcoat and was surprised that his hand, extended there at the end of his arm, was such a whole, functioning thing. Someone behind him seemed to be helping him get his arms through the sleeves of the coat. Blindly, he grabbed a hat from the shelf above the coat hooks. He stumbled through his front door. 2. The face was smiling down at him from an upstairs window in Eva Galley's old house.
"Get along now."
Moving a little oddly as if drunk, he went down the walk, his feet in carpet slippers, not registering the cold, and turned in the direction of town. Until he reached the corner, he could feel that house across the street as a presence behind him. When he managed to get as far as the corner, his open coat flapping about the trousers to the gray suit and the dinner jacket, he suddenly saw in his mind that the house was blazing, all of it blanketed in a transparent flame that was even now warming his back. But when he turned around to look, it was not burning. There were no transparent flames. Nothing had happened. Thus, when Ricky Hawthorne and Sears James were seated with Walt Hardesty in a farm kitchen drinking coffee, Dr. Jaffrey, a thin figure in a fishing hat, an unbuttoned coat, the trousers to one suit, the jacket to another, and carpet slippers, was moving past the front of the Archer Hotel. He was as little aware of it as he was of the wind which whipped his coat back and snapped it behind him. Eleanor Hardy, vacuuming the carpet in the hotel's lobby, saw him go by holding down his fishing hat and thought, "Poor Dr. Jaffrey, he has to go out to see a patient in this weather." The bottom of the window excluded the carpet slippers from her view of the doctor. She would have been confused to see him hesitate at the corner and turn down the left side of the square, in effect, going back the way he had come. When he passed the big windows of the Village Pump restaurant, William Webb, the young waiter Stella Hawthorne had intimidated, was setting out napkins and silverware, working his way toward the back of the restaurant where he could take a break and have a cup of coffee. Because he was nearer to Dr. Jaffrey than Eleanor Hardy had been, he took in the details of the doctor's pale, confused face beneath the fishing hat, the coat unbuttoned to reveal the doctor's bare neck, the tuxedo jacket over the pajama top. What went through his mind was, "The old fool's got amnesia." On the half-dozen occasions Bill Webb had seen Dr. Jaffrey in the restaurant, the doctor had read a book straight through his meal and left a minute tip. Because Jaffrey had begun to hurry, though the expression on his face suggested that he had no proper idea of where he was going, Webb dropped a handful of silverware on the table and rushed out of the restaurant. Dr. Jaffrey had begun to flap down the sidewalk. Webb ran after him and caught up with him at the traffic lights a block away. The doctor, running, was an angular bird.
Webb touched the sleeve of the black coat.
Dr. Jaffrey, can I help you?
Dr. Jaffrey.
In front of Webb, about to run across the street without bothering to check the traffic, which in any case was non-existent, Jaffrey turned around, having heard a toneless command. Bill Webb then was given one of the most unsettling experiences of his life. A man with whom he was acquainted, a man who had never looked at him with even polite curiosity, now regarded him with utter terror stamped into his features. Webb, who dropped his hand, had no idea that the doctor saw, instead of his ordinary slightly froggy face, that of a dead girl grinning redly at him.
"I'm going,"
the doctor said, his face still registering horror.
"I'm going now."
Sure, said Webb. The doctor turned and fled, and reached the other side of the street without mishap. He continued his bird-like run down the left side of Main Street, elbows hitching, coat twisting out behind him, and Webb was sufficiently unsettled by the look the doctor had given him to stand staring at him open-mouthed until he realized that he was coatless and a block from the restaurant. 3. In Dr. Jaffrey's mind, a perfect image had formed, far clearer than the buildings past which he fled. This was of the two-lane steel bridge over the little river into which Sears James had once thrown a blouse wrapped about a large stone. The fishing hat lifted from his head in a buffeting wind, and for a moment that was clear too, sailing handsomely through the gray air.
"I'm going now," he said.
Though on any normal day John Jaffrey could have gone straight to the bridge without even thinking about which streets would take him there, this morning he wandered about Milburn in a growing panic, unable to find it. He could picture the bridge perfectly. He saw even the rivets with their rounded heads, the flat, dull face of the metal. But when he tried to picture his location, he saw only fuzz. Buildings? He turned into Market Street, almost expecting to see the bridge lifting up between Burger King and the A&P. Seeing only the bridge, he had forgotten the river. Trees? A park? The picture the words evoked was so strong that he was surprised, leaving Market Street, to see about him only empty streets, snow heaped at the curbside.
"Move on, doctor."
He stumbled forward, righted himself by leaning against a barber pole, went on.
"Trees? Some trees scattered in a landscape? No, nor these floating buildings."
As the doctor wandered half-blindly through streets, he should have known, tacking from the square to Washington Street on the south, then over to Milgram Lane, and down declining Milgram Lane past three-room wooden houses, set between car washes and drugstores, into the hollow and real poverty, where he would be as close to unknown as he could be, and still be in Milburn. Here he might have been in trouble if it hadn't been so cold, and if trouble hadn't become a meaningless concept to apply to him. Several people saw him go. The hollow people who saw him go thought he was just another crazy, doomed and oddly dressed. When he accidentally turned back in the right direction and crossed back into quiet streets where bare trees stood at the ends of long lawns, those who saw him assumed that the doctor's car was nearby, because he had begun to move in a slow trot and was hatless. A mailman who grabbed his arm and said, "Man, do you need help?" was shocked into helplessness by the same wide-open gaze of terror that had stopped Bill Webb. Eventually, Dr. Jaffrey wound back into the business district. When he had twice circled Benjamin Harrison Oval, both times going right past Bridge Approach Lane, a patient voice in his mind said,
"Go around once more and take the second right turn, doctor."
"Thank you,"
he whispered, having heard amusement as well as patience in the voice he'd once heard as inhumanly toneless. So once more,
Exhausted and half-frozen, John Jeffrey forced himself to move painfully past the tire repair outfits and muffler centers of Benjamin Harrison Oval, and lifting his knees like a worn-out milk horse, at last made the turn into Bridge Approach Lane.
"Of course," he sobbed,
seeing it at last, the gray arch of the bridge over the sluggish river. He could trot no further. By now, in fact, he could barely walk. One of the slippers had fallen off, and the foot it had covered was entirely without sensation. He had a flaming stitch in his left side. His heart thudded. His lungs were one vast ache. The bridge was an answered prayer. He trudged toward it. This was where the bridge belonged. Here in this windy area where the old brick buildings gave way to weedy marshland, here where the wind felt like a hand holding him back.
"Now, doctor,"
he nodded, and as he drew nearer he saw where he could stand. Four big scallops of metal, themselves cross-hatched by girders, formed an undulating line on either side of the bridge. In the middle of the bridge, between the second and third metal curves, a thick steel girder protruded upward. Jaffrey could not feel the change from the concrete of the road to the steel of the bridge, but he could feel the bridge move beneath him, lifting a little with each particularly strong gust. When he reached the superstructure, he pulled himself along on the rail. After reaching the central girder, he gripped one of the rungs, put his frozen feet on the bottom rung, and tried to climb up to the flat rail. He could not do it. For a moment he stood there, hands on one rung and feet on another, like an old man hanging from a rope, breathing so heavily it sounded like sobbing. He managed to lift his slippered foot and put it on the next rung. Then, by using what he felt was surely the last of his strength, he pulled his body up onto it. Some flesh from his bare foot adhered to the lower rung. Panting, he stood on the second rung and saw that he had two more rungs to go before he would be high enough to stand on the flat rail. One at a time, he transferred his hands to the next highest rung. Then he moved the slippered foot, and with what felt like heroic effort moved the other. Pain seared his entire leg, and he clung to the supports. The bare foot lifted into cold wind. For a moment, his foot blazing, he feared that shock would tumble him back down onto the bridge. Once down, he would never be able to climb up again. Delicately, he put the toes of his still flaming foot on the rung. It was enough to hold him. Again he transferred his numb arms. The slippered foot went up a rung, by itself, it seemed. He tried to pull himself up, but his arms merely trembled. It felt as though the muscles in his shoulders were separating. Finally, he threw himself up, assisted, he thought, by a hand pushing upward in the small of his back. His fingers luckily caught the rung, and he was nearly there. For the first time he noticed his bare foot, bleeding onto the metal. The pain had increased. Now his entire left leg seemed to be in flames. He put the foot down onto the flat rail and held tightly with both exhausted arms while he moved his right foot beside it. The water glistened feebly beneath him. Wind buffeted his hair, his coat. Standing before him on a platform of gray wind, dressed in tweed jacket and bow tie, was Ricky Hawthorne. Ricky's hands were clasped in a characteristic gesture before his belt buckle.
"Good work, John," he said in his dry, kind voice.
The best of them all, the sweetest, cuckolded little Ricky Hawthorne.
"You take too much guff from Sears,"
John Jaffrey said, his voice weak and whispery.
"You always did."
"I know," Ricky smiled. "I'm a natural subaltern. Sears was always a natural general."
"Wrong,"
Jaffrey tried to say.
"He's not.
He's...
The thought died. It doesn't matter, came the light, dry voice. Just step forward off the bridge, John.
Dr. Jaffrey was looking down at the gray water.
No, I can't. I had something different in mind. I was going...
Confusion took it away. When he looked up again, he gasped. Edward Wanderley, who had been closer to him than any of the others, was standing on the wind instead of Ricky. As on the night of the party, he wore black shoes, a gray flannel suit, a flowered shirt. Black-rimmed spectacles were joined at the bows by a silvery cord. Handsome in his theatrical gray hair and expensive clothes, Edward smiled at him with compassion, concern, warmth.
"It's been a little while," he said.
Dr. Jaffrey began to weep.
"It's time to stop messing around," Edward told him. "All it takes is one step. It's simple as hell, John."
Dr. Jaffrey nodded.
"So take the step, John. You're too tired to do anything else."
Dr. Jaffrey stepped off the bridge. Below him, at the level of the water, but protected from the wind by a thick steel plate, Omar Norris saw him hit the water. The doctor's body went under, surfaced a moment later, and spun halfway around, face down, before it began to drift downriver with the current.
"Shit!" he said.
He'd come to the one place he could think of where he could finish off a pint of bourbon without being cornered by lawyers, the sheriff, his wife, or someone telling him to get on the snowplow and start clearing the streets. He tilted more bourbon into his mouth, closed his eyes. When he opened them, it was still there, lower in the water because the heavy coat had begun to weight the body down.
Shit!
He capped the bottle, stood up, and went back out into the wind to see if he could find someone who would know what to do. Chapter 2. Jaffrey's Party.
"Give place, you ladies, and begone. Boast not yourselves at all. For here at hand approacheth one whose face will stain you all."
A praise of his lady. Tottle's Miscellany, 1557. 1. The following events occurred a year and a day earlier, in the evening of the last day of the Golden Age. None of them knew it was their Golden Age, nor that it was coming to an end. In fact, they would have seen their lives in the usual fashion of people with comfortable existences, a sufficiency of friends and the certainty of food on the table, as a process of gradual and even imperceptible improvement. Having survived the crises of youth and the middle years, they thought they had wisdom enough to meet the coming crises of age, having seen wars, adulteries, compromise, and change. They thought that they had seen most everything they would see. They'd make no larger claim. Yet there were things they had not seen, and which they would see in time. It is always true in personal, if not historical, terms that a golden age's defining characteristic is its dailiness, its offered succession of the small satisfactions of daily living. If none in the Chowder Society but Ricky Hawthorne truly appreciated this, in time they would all know it. 2.
"I suppose we have to go."
"What? You always like parties, Stella."
"I have a funny feeling about this one."
"Don't you want to meet that actress?"
"My interest in meeting little beauties of 19 was always limited."
"Edward seems to have become rather taken with her."
"Oh, Edward," Stella, seated before her mirror and brushing her hair, smiled at Ricky's reflection. "I suppose it'll be worth going just to see Louis Benedict's reaction to Edward's find." Then the smile changed key as the fine muscles beside her mouth moved, became more edged.
At least it's something to be invited to a Chowder Society evening.
It's not, it's a party, Ricky vainly pointed out.
I've always thought that women should be allowed during those famous evenings of yours.
I know that, Ricky said.
And that's why I want to go.
It's not the Chowder Society, it's just a party.
Then who had John invited besides you and Edward's little actress?
Everybody, I think, Ricky answered truthfully.
What's the feeling you said you had?
Stella cocked her head, touched her lipstick with her little finger, looked into her summery eyes and said,
Goose over my grave.
3. Sitting beside Ricky as he drove her car the short distance to Montgomery Street, Stella, who had been unusually silent since they'd left the house, said,
Well, if everybody really is going to be there, maybe there'll be a few new faces.
As she had meant him to, Ricky felt a mocking blade of jealousy pierce him.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Stella's voice was light, musical, confidential, as if she had intended nothing that was not superficial.
What is?
That one of you is having a party. The only people we know who have parties are us, and we have about 2 a year. I can't get over it. John Jaffrey. I'm amazed Millie Sheehan let him get away with it.
The glamour of the theater world, I imagine, Ricky said.
Millie doesn't think anything is glamorous except John Jaffrey, Stella replied,
and laughed at the image of their friend she could find in every glance of his housekeeper. Stella, who in certain practical matters was wiser than any of the men about her, sometimes titillated herself with the notion that Dr. Jaffrey took some sort of dope. And she was convinced that Millie and her employer did not occupy separate beds. Considering his own remark, Ricky had missed his wife's insight. The glamour of the theater world, as remote and unlikely as any such thing seemed in Millburn, did seem to have gripped Jaffrey's imagination. He, whose greatest enthusiasm had been for a neatly hooked trout, had become increasingly obsessed with Edward Wanderley's young guest during the previous 3 weeks. Edward himself had been very secretive about the girl. She was new, she was very young. She was, for the moment, a star, whatever that really meant, and such people provided Edward's livelihood. So it was not exceptional that Edward had persuaded her to be the latest subject of his ghosted autobiographies. The typical procedure was that Edward had his subjects talk into a tape recorder for as many weeks as their interest held. Then, with a great deal of skill, he worked these memories into a book. The rest of the research was done through the mails and over the telephone, with anybody who knew or had once known his subject. Genealogical research, too, was a part of Edward's method. Edward was proud of his genealogies. The recording was done whenever possible at his house. His study walls were lined with tapes, tapes on which, it was understood, many juicy and unpublishable indiscretions were recorded. Ricky himself had only the most notional interest in the personalities and sex lives of actors, and so he thought did the rest of his friends. But when Everybody Saw the Sunshine underwent a month's change of cast, which Anne Veronica Moore spent in Millburn, John Jaffrey had increasingly had one goal, to have this girl come to his house. An even greater mystery was that his hints and schemes had succeeded, and the girl had consented to attend a party in her honor.
"Good Lord," Stella said, seeing the number of cars lined at the curb before Jaffrey's house. It's Jan's coming out party, Ricky said. He wants to show off his accomplishment.
They parked down the block and slipped through cold air to the front door. Voices, music, pulsed at them.
I'll be damned, Ricky said. He's using his offices, too.
Which was the truth? A young man pressed up against the door by the crowd let them in. Ricky recognized him as the latest occupant of the galley house. He accepted Ricky's thanks with a deferential grin and then smiled at Stella.
Mrs. Hawthorne, isn't it? I've seen you around town, but we've never been introduced.
Before Ricky could remember the man's name, he had offered Stella his hand and said,
Freddie Robinson, I live across the street.
A pleasure, Mr. Robinson.
This is some party.
I'm sure it is, said Stella, the faintest of smiles tipping the edges of her mouth.
Coats in the consulting room here, drinks upstairs. I'd be happy to get you one while you and your husband take care of your coats.
Stella looked at his blazer, his plaid trousers, his floppy velvet bow tie, his absurdly eager face.
That won't be necessary, I'm sure, Mr. Robinson.
She and Ricky dodged into the consulting room where coats were flung everywhere.
Good God, said Stella. What does that young man do for a living? I think he sells insurance.
I should have known.
Take me upstairs, Ricky.
Holding her cool hand, Ricky led her out of the consulting room and through the lower fringe of the party to the stairs. A record player on a table thumped out disco music. Young people strutted, wriggled before it.
John's had a brainstorm, Ricky muttered. If not sunstroke, Stella said behind him.
Hiya, Mr. Hawthorne.
This was from a tall boy in his late teens, a client's son.
Hello, Peter. It's too noisy for us down here. I'm looking for the Glenn Miller wing.
Peter Barnes's clear blue eyes regarded him expressionlessly. Did he seem that foreign to young people?
Hey, what do you know about Cornell? I think that's where I want to go to college. I might be able to get early admission. Hiya, Mrs. Hawthorne.
It's a good school. I hope you make it, said Ricky.
Stella poked him smartly in the back.
Oh, no sweat. I know I'll get in. I got 700s on my trial boards. Dad's upstairs. Do you know what?
No, Stella prodded him again.
What? All of us were invited because we're about the same age as Anne Veronica Moore, but they just took her upstairs as soon as she and Mr. Wanderley got here. We never even got to talk to her.
He gestured around at the couples doing the hustle in the small downstairs room.
Jim Hardy kissed her hand, though. He's always doing things like that. He really grosses everybody out.
Ricky saw Eleanor Hardy's son doing a series of ritualistic dance steps with a girl whose black hair flowed down to the small of her back. It was Penny Drager, the daughter of a druggist who was a client. She twitched away, spun, lifted a foot, and then placed her behind squarely on Hardy's crotch.
He sounds like a promising boy, Stella purred.
Peter, would you do me a favor?
Sure,
the boy gulped.
What?
Clear a space so that my husband and I can go upstairs.
Sure, yeah, but you know what? We were just invited to meet Anne Veronica Moore, and then we were supposed to go home. Mrs. Sheehan said we can't even go upstairs. I guess they thought she'd like to dance with us or something, but they didn't even give her a chance. And at 10 o'clock... Mr. Sheehan said she was going to throw us all out. Except for him, I suppose.
He nodded at Freddie Robinson, who had one arm around the shoulders of a giggling high school girl.
Terribly unfair, Stella said. Now be a good boy and carve a way through the undergrowth.
Oh, yeah.
He took them across the crowded room to the staircase, as if he were reluctantly leading an outing from the local asylum. When they were safely on the stairs, and Stella had already begun to go regally up, he bent forward and whispered in Ricky's ear,
"Will you do something for me, Mr. Hawthorne?"
Ricky nodded.
"Say hello to her for me, will you? She's a real piece."
Ricky laughed aloud, causing Stella to turn her head and look at him quizzically.
"Nothing, darling," he said,
and went up the stairs to the quieter regions of the house. They saw John Jaffrey standing in the hallway, rubbing his hands together. Soft piano music drifted from the living rooms.
"Stella, Ricky, isn't this wonderful?"
He gestured expansively toward the rooms. They were as crowded as those downstairs, but with middle-aged men and women, the parents of the teenagers, Jaffrey's neighbors and acquaintances. Ricky saw two or three of the prosperous farmers from outside town. Rollo Drager, the druggist, Lewis Price, a commodity broker, who had given him one or two good ideas, Harlan Bouts, his dentist, who already seemed tipsy, some men he didn't know, but who he thought were probably from the university. Millie Sheehan had a nephew who taught there, he remembered. Clark Mulligan, who ran the town's movie theater. Walter Barnes and Edward Venuti from the bank, each in a snowy turtleneck. Ned Rowles, who edited the local paper. Eleanor Hardy, both hands on a tall glass held at the level of her breasts, was tilting her high-browed face toward Louis Benedict. Sears was leaning against a bookcase, looking out of sorts. Then the crowd parted, and Ricky saw why. Ermengarde Drager, the druggist's wife, was blathering in his ear, and Ricky knew what she was saying.
"I went to Skidmore. Well, I had 3 years before I met Rollo. Don't you think I deserve something better than this one-horse town? Honestly, if it wasn't for Penny, I'd pack up and leave this minute."
It was the melody, if not exactly the lyric, and Ermengarde had set the past 10 years of her life to it.
"I don't know why I never did it before," John said, his face gleaming. "I feel younger tonight than I have in a decade."
"How wonderful, John," Stella said, leaning forward to kiss his cheek. "What does Millie think of it?"
"Not much," he looked bemused. "She couldn't figure out why I wanted to have a party in the first place. She couldn't understand why I wanted to have Miss Moore here at all."
Millie herself came into view at that moment, holding a tray of canapés before Barnes and Venuti, the two bankers, and from the determined look on Millie's plump face, Ricky saw that she had opposed the idea from the first.
"Why did you want to?"
"Excuse me, John, I'm going to mill," said Stella. "Don't worry about getting me a drink, Ricky. I'll take one from someone who isn't using his."
She went through the doorway in the direction of Ned Rowles. Lou Price, gangsterish in a double-breasted pinstriped suit, took her hand and pecked her on the cheek.
"She's a wonderful gal," John Jaffrey said,
and the two men watched Stella deflect Lou Price with a phrase and continue toward Ned Rowles.
"I wish there were a million like her."
Rowles was turning around to watch Stella approach him, his face lighting up with pleasure. In his corduroy jacket with his sandy hair and earnest face, Ned Rowles resembled a journalism student more than an editor. He too kissed Stella, but on the mouth, and held both her hands as he did so.
"Why did I want to?"
John cocked his head, and four deep wrinkles divided the side of his neck.
"I don't know exactly. Edward's so entranced with this girl that I wanted to meet her."
"Is he entranced?"
"Oh, absolutely. You wait, you'll see. And then, you know, I only ever see my patients and Millie and the Chowder Society. I thought it was time to bust out a little, have a little fun before I dropped dead."
This was very giddy for John Jaffrey, and Ricky glanced at his friend, taking his eyes from his wife, who was still holding hands with Ned Rowles.
"And do you know what I can't get over? One of the most famous actresses in America is upstairs in my house right this minute.
Is Edward with her?
He said she had to take a few minutes before she joined us. I guess he's helping her with her coat or something.
Jeffrey's ravaged face simply gleamed with pride.
I don't think she's quite yet one of the most famous actresses in America, John.
Stella had moved on, and Ned Rolls was saying something vehement to Ed Venuti.
Well, she will be. Edward thinks so, and he's always right about things like that.
Ricky,
Jaffrey gripped his upper arms,
did you see the kids dancing downstairs? Isn't that fantastic? Kids having a good time in my house? I thought they'd enjoy meeting her. It's a fantastic honor, you know. She can only be here a few more days. Edward's got the taping nearly done, and she has to get back to New York to rejoin the play. And here she is, in my house, by God, Ricky!
Ricky felt almost as though he should press a cold cloth to Jaffrey's forehead.
Did you know that she just came out of nowhere? That she was the most promising student in her drama class, and the next week she got her part in Everybody Saw the Sunshine?
No, John.
Just now I had a wonderful idea. It was about having her here in the house. I was standing here, listening to the kids' disco music from downstairs and hearing bits and pieces of the George Shearing record from in there, and I thought, downstairs is the raw animal life, kids jumping around to that beat. On this floor we've got the mental life, doctors and lawyers, all middle-class respectability. And upstairs is grace, talent, beauty, the spirit. You see? It's like evolution. She's the most ethereal thing you've ever seen, and she's only 18.
Never in his life had Ricky heard John Jaffrey express such a fanciful concept. He was beginning to worry about the doctor's blood pressure. Then both men heard a door close up on the next landing, followed by Edward's deep voice, saying something that had the sly intonation of a joke.
I thought Stella said she was 19, Ricky said.
Shh!
A beautiful little girl was coming toward them down the stairs. Her dress was simple and green. Her hair was a cloud. After a second, Ricky saw that her eyes matched the dress. Moving with a kind of rhythmic, idle precision, she gave them the tiniest of smiles. Still, it was brilliant, and went by, patting Dr. Jaffrey's chest with her fingertips as she passed them. Ricky watched her go, amused and touched. He had seen nothing like it since Louise Brooks in Pandora's Box. Then he looked at Edward Wanderley and saw at once that John Jaffrey was right. Edward's feathers were shining. He had obviously been stirred up by the girl, and it was equally obvious that it was difficult for him to leave her alone long enough to greet his friends. All three men began to move into the crowded living room.
"Ricky, you look great," Edward told him, putting an arm easily around Ricky's shoulders. Edward was half a foot taller, and when Edward began to propel him into the room, Ricky could smell an expensive cologne.
"Just great. But isn't it time you stopped wearing bow ties? The Arthur Schlesinger era is dead and gone."
"That was the era right after mine," Ricky said.
"Now, listen, nobody's older than he feels. I stopped wearing neckties altogether. In 10 years, 80% of the men in this country will wear ties only to weddings and funerals. Barnes and Venuti over there will be wearing that get-up to the bank." He scanned the room. Where the hell did she go? Ricky, in whom new ties evoked a desire to wear them even to bed, looked at Edward's unfettered neck as his friend surveyed the crowded room, saw that it was